creature.
Apparently, I don't know who said this to me recently. Someone said the vest keeps you cool when you're hot and warms you up when you're cold. Apparently, vests, you know, they're not just a stupid, fuddy duddy thing. Apparently, vests are correct.
Oh, let's get into vests.
Vest, I don't know, vests has got the ring of a bit of classic Cochrane to it.
I do wear a vest.
Hang on, Mickey's got stuff on vests, doesn't he?
Yeah, of course he has.
Yeah, it's good done.
Of course he has. That's the trouble with observation. Okay, we've got the slowest kettle on earth, two teas about to be ready.
Oh, my voice is a little bit rubbish as well. I died on my arse last night. I fucking died.
Let's talk about that.
I did a preview and to an hour of silence in Islington. Four laughs.
Did you record it?
Yes, I did record the preview. There's no point listening to it.
Well,
there's no point.
I disagree. I sometimes think, should we do this when we're up and running? I sometimes think.
The only thing that's stopping us being up and running is the kettle, so let's save this thing.
Okay.
I said on the thing, so many people, this podcast appears to be inspiring a lot of people, so I want to also present, this is what it's like when you die. Do you know what I mean?
What, are people starting stand-up because of it?
Well, a couple of people, have said so. That's exactly what I said. There's, you know, it's not about encouraging people to do it, but I think it is having that effect, because there's this irresistible swell of, hey man, let's all do stand-up.
I wish they'd all fuck off. charitable, isn't it?
The word daydreams has just reminded me of Alan Cochrane is a daydreamer at night, and which one of your Edinburgh shows?
It was,
and that in turn reminded me of, so you did quite an unusual thing at Edinburgh, whereby having established a style, you then, was it 2 years ago, did your one-liner show?
Yeah,
2 or 3 years ago.
I don't look back on that year very fondly.
Well, talk us through the process of that, because that was a very brave thing to put your style, your established style, to one side and try, and you tried to do a show which was entirely one-liners or contained one-liners. What was the plan behind that?
I thought I was going to do one-liners, and then eventually I realised that I didn't particularly like writing them and I didn't particularly like telling them, and I also had a couple of other things that I wanted to talk about. But really, I mean, I like one-liner guys, but their quality control is so difficult, because the same joke one night gets a massive laugh and the next night sounds naff. Like, it's a really weird thing, depending on sort of the narrative of what's gone before it in the set and how things have been responded to. So I sometimes look at those one-liner guys and think, oh wow, they've just got a belly laugh from that. But I, when I was writing one-liners, would have binned that, thinking it was naff.
Yeah.
And similarly, some of the stuff I kept that I tried, people would look at me like, what the fuck is this? Why are you saying that?
Yeah.
But really, they're quite fun to write, because they're basically two stories, aren't they, in one line. You know, you send them one way and then you send them another way, and it's all an exercise in concise sentence structure, really. You know, there's a way of putting the funniest words at the end of the sentence, but I never use any of the jokes that were in that tub, even the good ones. I would never...
The tub that you had on stage.
I had a tub full of jokes that I drew out in a sort of inconsequential order, and I thought it was fun to have callbacks in there. So sometimes the callback would come out before the actual joke. and I thought, oh, the reveal on that will be really good fun and gratifying, and it wasn't always.
But so the ones in the tub, you no longer use any of those jokes?
I wouldn't use any of them. And even the ones that were pretty much bankers in the tub, that I would relish pulling those ones out compared to the other ones. And some of them sort of seem a bit naff. I just think there's something. I can't make my mind up. I admire people that can say my jokes. You know, those sort of one-liner comics that quite often they have jokes about their jokes.
Yeah.
They'll say, I'm just here with my jokes. And I would never really do that.
Yeah,
because
if
you're doing kind of everyday observational stuff, you don't really call it your jokes, because you feel like that's slightly giving away the fact that it's not your life.
It's a very different thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit like when people say this is true and you think, what, is everything else not?
Yeah, yeah. That's what you could always say if someone's like, and this genuinely happened, I always think, no, it didn't.
Really?
That's yeah, no, it didn't. If you're saying this is genuinely the case, because you want us to believe something that you've convinced yourself actually happened, but it didn't.
Yeah, and weirdly, the way to tell people lies is to just believe them, and it don't say this is genuinely true, just say this happens. Like, you just
this
do it
spurious peach incident you've made
exactly,
up.
Exactly. But you don't know how many things I've seen on trains that I've had to discard. Because
no one will believe.
I once saw an Orthodox Jew get a bottle of Coca-Cola and drink it from the lid. He was pouring it into the lid and taking tiny little sips. And again, started as a text message. I was texting my friend who's a Jew saying, is this a Jew thing, or is this just an example?
How Jewish is this guy? Yeah, is this on extra level?
What is this? But, you know, that is never going to become a routine because it's too weird and specific. Yeah. I was also once on a train on the way home and... an Asian gentleman came on, left his laptop and said, left his bag and said, I'm going to the toilet, and was at the toilet for ages, and it was at the height of terror alert. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, don't be silly, don't bow to this stupid media pressure. So then he comes back, and I've bought wine for my train journey, so I was just about to open wine and put my headphones on, and he says, I'm really sorry, I'm going to sit right opposite you and I need to do my prayers because Mecca's that way. So he starts praying right in front of me.
Wow.
I'm thinking, this is a terrible time to open wine and put music on. So I left it, and then he finished praying, got his laptop out of his bag, took a brand new copy of the Deer Hunter DVD out, unwrapped the cellophane and sat and watched Deer Hunter opposite. And you think, he's not a terrorist, he's just a guy who's had a bit of a prayer and now he's watching a film. But again, you couldn't talk about that unless... Well, actually, weirdly, I think I couldn't talk about that just in and of itself. But if I had another bit of material that was about... I don't know, political correctness or discomfort in the modern world or something, I would probably consider that. I would probably think, oh, maybe I can put that in and bolster it with a few jokes. And sometimes ideas or things that happen to me, they sort of go into this like murky recesses in the back of my mind where they kind of need another idea to join on. You know, a bit like the peach over a sink bolted onto... Yeah. Seeing a guy on a train. I think sometimes two ideas are funnier than one half idea. That should be really obvious, shouldn't it? But that is kind of how it works with me, I think. It's slightly different this year because I'm not doing the Edinburgh Festival. So usually I have, rather than a weekly schedule of writing, I usually have a yearly thing of... I do the Edinburgh Festival in August and then I tour it ideally up until about December, and then January I start thinking, right, I need a new show again by next August. So usually springtime I'm in comedy clubs doing a brand new 20, often dying after someone who's been doing the same 20 for 15 years and it's as bulletproof as you like. I have to say I'm a bit fed up of that pattern of the year, and so now if I'm on in a comedy club next weekend I can do whatever I want because I'm not doing the Edinburgh Festival this year. But it's been slightly frustrating for perhaps the last 3 years, going, I could do really well in this room but I'm doing 10 minutes that I want to be good in August. Why? So I'm not that comfortable with the false ending of Edinburgh. But you know, there's no set time for me to write because my life is very travelling based, so I write on trains. I will literally get my headphones on and listen to old gigs and just scribble ideas that are extra jokes whilst I'm on trains. I also occasionally sit and go through newspapers and try and write topical jokes if I'm doing a panel game or whatever. So I can kind of write to order, but they're not gags, they're often my angles. Well, you're not scribbling down panel games, are you?
I was going to ask you about how you prepare for that.
Well, why that reaction? Well, I worry slightly about the competitive nature of panel games. I mean, I like, I'm quite happy with bloodthirsty gigs. I don't mind stand-up being gladiatorial, but I think when stand-up on telly becomes gladiatorial, you kind of run the risk of taking the fun out of it, because those panel games could be a way of getting seven really funny people to have a really funny conversation. But as it is, what you get is seven really funny people ignoring each other and trying to say their funny thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that I find pretty disinteresting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would much rather see those people either love or loathe each other for a reason that's come up in the conversation, rather than just operating like weird, you know, not listening to each other people. Because then if you do, if you're on those programs and you say a funny thing, you kind of want funny people to respond to it. One of the brilliant things about this job is hanging around with other funny people.
Yeah.
And making them really piss themselves. You know, when you're sitting in a cafe late night in Edinburgh and you've just made eight comics that you think are fucking brilliant piss themselves, that's part of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be part of being on a panel game, that time when you go, oh, I made so and so and so and so properly hoot with laughter, and they've been comic heroes of mine for a long time.
Yeah,
but as it
is, there's nothing like that feeling, is there, really?
As it's going, you're kind of going, oh, I got interrupted by them, or mm-hmm. or not. I said a really funny thing that I was hoping they'd like, and they were looking at their notes, waiting for their go.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't love them, but they are what they are, aren't they? Is that me being diplomatic?
No, that's absolutely fine. I interrupted you there. We were talking about how much you write. So you don't. There's no time when you're at home when you think, right, this is my number of hours or minutes for today or anything like that.
I think there should be, in truth. I really do. And I think all of my best, kind of biggest bits of material over the last 5 years, say, they've all got better by me sitting at a table, often late at night when the house is quiet, and just writing it out. And I think it might have been Mike Wilmot once told me a really good way of writing stand-up is to sit down and try and write out your act. So try and write out, hello, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and then your first routine. Because the pen works slower than your mind. And by writing that, you start to think of extra things that you could do and say. And I find trying to just write out longhand a routine that is already quite strong makes it stronger.
That's a really good tip. I've never tried doing that.
I really think it works, because, you know, say you've got a bit about cheese. As you're writing, I was eating Wensleydale the other day, you're also waiting, your mind is waiting for the pen to catch up, and during that waiting time you might well have an idea about a joke.
So yeah.
I think in truth, the Edinburgh deadline has made some stuff stronger that it wouldn't necessarily have got stronger. But I really respond well to that. I'm doing some TV stand-up tomorrow night, and I find that helps as well, because I kind of go, oh, I could do that old bit that I used to do. And then by thinking about it before the TV thing, I'll bolster it with a few new bits as well. So again, that thing of half ideas becoming whole ideas. I do that quite a lot. I try and stick on extra jokes for old things to jazz it up. But really, I don't actively sit down and write enough, and that's a shame. But you know, we've all got our own different self-loathings, haven't we? The one-liners thing, I didn't find them particularly difficult to write. I found them difficult to have any knowledge of whether or not they were terrible or brilliant.
Yes,
and
okay.
I found that quite unsatisfying, because there's a weirdly easy way of making them good. The most effective one in the tub was, my friend says his wife never looks as beautiful as she does when she's playing the piano. I prefer it when she licks her own tits. And I really like that as a joke, but I'm also aware that the word tits is funny.
Yes, I see what you mean.
And so
it's difficult to know where to credit the laugh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so for me, this, I don't really find that appealing to use. And also, it's too set up punch for for my thing. Although I've got set up punch jokes in my act, but they're usually about the topic that I'm talking about. You know, maybe if I was doing a routine about attractiveness, I could smuggle that in and make it sound like it's in a routine, but it would still stand out like a bit da-dum.
Sure. And that doesn't sit so well, does it, with your...
It's not even that it doesn't sit so well. I just think it slightly jolts people. It's like a little speed bump or something. They kind of go, oh, this was flowing, and then there was that... I don't know.
Yeah.
But I do like it when I get jokes.
I'm forever sticking my makeup girl joke. You know, I joke about my girlfriend. I've got a new girlfriend. She's a makeup lady, by which I mean she isn't real. And I really like it. Like, when I wrote that, I proper went, whoa, that's really good.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, had to text and email a couple of people and go, have I lifted this without knowing it? Because I don't think... I mean, that's a great... I really like that.
Other friends offer you that I don't get.
Yeah, I don't think you're
after the bad gigs and they tell you whether or not your stuff is yours.
Totally. but I frequently try and slip that in when I'm talking about my girlfriend or talking about sex or relationships or something.
Yeah.
And of late I've noticed... that it's a speed bump, because even though it's a funny joke, it's the wrong sort of joke, and they go, it actually makes it seem like they can't trust me anymore,
right?
Because it might just be the setup to something daft.
Yes, well, there are definitely those acts, and quite often the people that are kind of slightly shallow people that do political stuff, and they'll say a thing that you think, oh well, this is a serious point, and you go, no, it's not. There's a joke about Obama coming. It's on its way. Oh, yeah. There it is. You know, it's that. You don't want to be that guy, do you?
So when in the week, let's talk about a working week for you.
Yes, let's.
And all the... Everyone I've spoken to has had different kind of reactions to this wildly. How much writing do you do in an average week? Is there an average week?
No, there's not really an average week.
I speak as someone who's frequently crashed over in your spare room, which is your very well-appointed library with a desk and a computer and stuff.
Yeah, we have a nice spare room.
And I've never seen you, obviously, because I've been kipping in there, I've never seen you at the desk writing. Do you spend a lot of time doing that? What's the...
No, funnily enough, I have a weird block about that particular room in my house.
Oh, I remember you saying, what was that about?
I think it's because that's where we have a business chat about the bookkeeping, and I think it's now become the least funny room in the home. Because the moment you've got it licked, it serves you up a huge slice of humble pie, doesn't it? The moment you think, right, I think I'm getting quite good at this, you end up in front of a hen do of 25 and they're interrupting your nuanced bit of stand-up that you've really enjoyed putting together and that worked in an arts centre on the Tuesday, and so then you have to go back and go, all right, stop, check, and what other stuff have we got?
I don't think there's a week goes by without me thinking of another great bit of advice you've handed on to me, which I think was from Russell Howard.
Maybe.
You said Russell had said something along the lines of, the great thing about stand-up is if you're feeling awful about it, you know that in 3 months you're going to feel great about it again.
I think it was in 3 months you could.
Oh, yeah. Not necessarily.
You could feel great about it, or you could feel like your stuff could be brilliant. I think there is a certain thing of when you plumb the depths, there is almost a feeling of going, oh, well, you know, this is... I suppose the longer you do it, the more you know that there is an up and down to it. Like, I was... I think one of the reasons that I get on with the comedian friends that I get on with is that when we were starting, I remember feeling that some comics were more hurt by deaths than others. And at the time of doing stand-up and becoming a stand-up, I had read quite a lot of comedians telling about their experience. I read that Ha Bloody Ha, Comedians Talking, that William Cook wrote. And I remember thinking... death is part of the process. Like, it's not great, and I don't want to die, but it is part of it. And it's like dropping and juggling, isn't it? If you don't drop, you're not learning. And so it just seemed to me like the odd death was part of going from open spot to paid act. And they're still crippling. They still aren't fun, but they are part of it. And so I think there are some comics that overreact to the point where you go, what, this is what it is, it's not going to work every night, who told you that? So yeah, when you are feeling a bit low about it, there is almost an energising of it. That's why, in a way, those acts that don't change a word for 15 years, they're fucking commendable, because they have to sell it as well as they did the first time they did it, because nobody's jokes work that well without a bit of input. You really need to... I mean, my oldest stuff I still need to be engaged with as I say it, I think. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know. I would love to have 20 minutes worth of jokes that just did all the work for me, that I could just stand there and mutter.
Yeah.
But I really need to be me, especially as I'm getting older and more tired and there are more demands on my time during the day. I find that if I'm not feeling fit and okay and in a good mood, like being in a good mood is the difference between a set being charming and a set being fine.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, what was I on about? I've forgotten about the 3 months from thing. Yeah. Sorry. Is this the end?
I think it is.
Not of the interview, of my career.
That's it. It's all over now. Alan Cochran, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's a bit formal. I don't know how it ends. I just end it.
Yeah, you have guitar licks, don't you? To
yeah, that's my friend Dan in Manchester.
That's the Seinfeld music.